That'd be why.
Awesome. Right when you are, Esther.
Yeah, whenever you are. That's. I just kind of wait for the red light. Oh. Then I start.
Sorry.
All right. No problem. Good morning. It's a little after 10 a.m. on February 10th, 2010. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission at its regularly scheduled biweekly meeting. Kevin Kramer along with Tony Clark and Brian Kalk. Welcome to everybody. Any opening comments from my colleagues?
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, welcome, and go Saints.
Who did?
Wasn't that cool? Yeah. All right.
That was cool.
I would entertain a motion to pass the...
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
I just realized you're not Daryl.
And you're not Daryl. Yes, thank you. We'll begin the regular agenda. That's his brother. Yeah, my other brother, Daryl. Okay.
Jim.
Item number KC1. I move the commission award a contract to Minot Guarantee and Escrow Company in the amount of $1,500 for title work associated with the 2010 Beekler Velva AML construction project.
Second.
Obviously, there needs to be some a cost estimate for. Or we received a cost estimate for title memoranda for the private lands affected by the Beekler Velva project. We sent a letter to the abstract company that does work in Ward County. There's only one. Of course, we need a title memoranda that shows a complete chain of the title from patent to and including, of course, the current legal and equitable surface ownership interests, and then the date and manner ownership interests were acquired and any outstanding encumbrances on the lands. So in response to the letter, which was sent out January 13th, we received this bid from the only company, Minot Guarantee and Escrow Company, which does abstract work in Ward County. It should be noted that while this is there's only one bidder, this is half of the maximum amount that they could charge under state law, so we appreciate their reasonableness in doing this title work.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC2, similar to KC1, I move the commission issue an intent to award a contract and award a contract to Northwest Abstract and Title, Inc. in the amount of $300 for title work associated with the Williams County Road 9 Phase 5 AML project.
Second.
In this case, on January 13th, the letters were sent to the two abstract companies that do work in Williams County. We received bids from Northwest Abstract and Title, Inc. in the amount of $300 and then from Williams County Abstract in the amount of $749. So, obviously, in this case, the lower bid wins the award.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio, Commissioner Clark.
Thank you. TC1, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing corridor certificate and route permit to Basin Electric Power Cooperative for its proposed Williston to Tioga 230 kV electric transmission line in Williams and Montreal counties of North Dakota, case number PU07671.
Second.
This is a fairly significant transmission line that Basin Electric is proposing to build in the northwest part of the state. It is a line that is being constructed because of a very heavy load demand that has taken place over the last few years in the northwest part of the state, specifically related to the development of oil and gas in northwest North Dakota and the Bakken Formation. It is a line that is designed to increase the reliability and the deliverability of electricity to that area. Each of these new drilling units and all the associated facilities that are going in because of oil and gas development in the Bakken and in northwest North Dakota are significant energy users, and so this line will be going to help support that in large part, but also has benefits to the entire reliability of the grid in that area. It's 61 miles of 230 kV transmission line. The manner in which Basin is proposing to construct it is something which is gaining some popularity in North Dakota, I've noticed, and throughout the region, which is rather than the more traditional H-frame wood frames that we're used to for support structures. Here, Basin is proposing using self-supporting galvanized steel pole structures. They're approximately 100 feet tall, so they're fairly tall. But they do tend to take up less space than the H-frames. In addition, in those angle points where a traditional A-frame might need guy wires, these structures don't need it. They have foundations that are poured, and so it is generally viewed positively by the landowners who receive them because it makes them less impact on the land, and it makes it easier to conduct farming operations around them. The proposed corridor and route, and we are consolidating this hearing, and I'll make a comment on this in just a minute, but it's fairly straightforward. The route that was chosen didn't cause any great problems for the commission. We did hold a hearing in Williston at the end of October of last year. It does not include any exclusion areas. The corridor itself, which is 6 miles wide, contains several parks, campground, recreation areas, and so on and so forth, and those are all avoided. There were no unique or resources or endangered species that were identified along the route. The route does not cross any avoidance areas. There are no rural residences that are within 500 feet of the line. There are no permanent impacts that are detected on wetlands. As far as cultural resources, both Class 1 file searches and Class 3 cultural pedestrian surveys were conducted. Now, while there were a number of prehistoric and historic sites that were identified through the course of those activities, they are all being avoided, and it is unlikely that paleontological resources are going to be affected by the project. So as I said, everything in this is pretty much straightforward. The one thing which is a little bit different in this that we do note in ordering clause number 4 is related to a new section of state law. And this particular issue came up in discussion with the commission as we sat down around the table at our work session. A concern with the size of the corridor in relation to a new state law, which says that any corridor certificate, any certificate itself for a route or for a generation facility, for that matter, there's an ability for the holder of that certificate to potentially construct other facilities in that permitted area without coming back to the commission for a full siting, and there are reasons that the legislature did that. The concern is here that the corridor that was originally applied for is quite wide, and the commission does have some concern, given that new state law, permitting a corridor quite that wide that would then allow the applicant to come in and build other facilities potentially on that without any check or review from the commission. The width of a corridor is something that is within the commission's purview. We can ratchet that down, and I suspect in future cases, knowing this, we are going to require smaller corridors so that we don't have corridors quite that large. In this case, in discussions with Basin, they given that all the legwork was already done and it was cited as previous lines had been cited, they simply certified to the commission that if they do propose other route work in the corridor, they would come back to us for citing that.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC2, I move the commission adopt the order revoking warehouse license number 1156 of Organic Grain and Milling, Inc., Boulder, Colorado, at its Clyde, North Dakota warehouse, and order Organic Grain and Milling, Inc., to return grain elevator warehouse license number 1156 to the commission.
Second.
You may recall this from about a month ago. The license for Organic Grain and Milling for their Clyde facility was suspended for lack of an adequate bond, and after a suspension by statute, the company has 30 days to procure and file an adequate bond or submit a written request for hearing. We have received neither a bond nor a written request for hearing, so by virtue of state law, we will be revoking the elevator license, number 1156, to Organic Grain and Milling at Clyde, and ordering them to return the license to the commission.
All in favor?
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio.
Very good. Commissioner Culk.
Good morning. Item BK1. I move the commission adopt the order designating 211 dialing code user, granting First Link's request to use the 211 dialing code in Cass County, North Dakota, case number PU09713.
Second.
This one I'll kind of walk through a little bit. It's interesting. Our role on the PSC is simply to designate the 211 number. But going back in time, in September of 2003, this commission designated the Mental Health Association of North Dakota, referred to as MHAND, as the user of the 211 dialing code statewide. In March of 2007, the commission authorized MHAND to subcontract 211 operations in Cass County to FirstLink. So that carried on for a couple years. But in October of 2009, MHAND notified the commission that due to lack of economic support, they must relinquish their designation as a 211 dialing code user. So at that point, for a very brief period of time, we didn't have statewide 211 service. But in November, FirstLink was authorized to provide temporary services statewide until a decision was made about the future of the 211 service. On November 23rd, FirstLink indicated to us that they would like to consider doing it statewide. So therefore, November 25th, we issued a notice opportunity for hearing with comments and requests to be filed by 8 January of 2010. No additional comments were received at that time. January 27th, we held an informal hearing to discuss the situation. But basically what came out of it is the FirstLink was not interested in providing services statewide. They just wanted to continue their services in Cass County. So therefore, that's where we're at the motion today. But once again, understanding our role is just to designate the number. We talked during our work session that we didn't feel it was appropriate just to cancel the services without at least trying to organize some meeting. So at the conclusion of our meeting today, we're going to schedule a stakeholder meeting where we're going to try to get the folks together that could be affected by the loss of 211 services and see if they can somehow come up with funding for one of these service providers to continue the services. But as of right now, effective March 15th, FirstLink will be providing services in Cass County, and statewide services will be terminating.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And that concludes the items of my portfolio.
And that concludes the agenda, unless somebody has an announcement to make.
I'd just like to say that I compliment Commissioner Kalk on his Marine Corps tie.
Commander-in-Chief?
Well, I didn't know that that's how it was pronounced until this last week. Apparently, I'd been pronouncing Marine Corps wrong all these years.
Well, I believe you were correct.
I was.
Yeah, you're just not as educated as other people are. What is that great line about democracy, that democracy is turning government over to the uneducated as opposed to the badly educated? Anyway, something like that, referencing the common people, you know. So at any rate, let's see, we do have another meeting in a couple of weeks, and prior to that, I think the only other notice means that the work session on grain bonding, which is Thursday, February 18th, and then, of course, Monday, March 1. Just clarification, you guys can help me with this, or Esther, you probably know this. On March 1st, of course, are the BNSF Railway reviews of the railroad crossing, the private railroad crossing. We have a 10 a.m. hearing on the one issue and a 1:30 on the other issue. The 10 a.m. is scheduled for the hearing room, and the 1:30 issue is scheduled for the Brynhild-Hoagland room. Is that correct? So the morning hearing is then, I assume, is on whether it's private or public, that answering that question. Then in the afternoon would be the... Okay, the follow-up. I think that was at your encouragement, Dale. we just made sure it's in the Brynhild Hoagland.
Yeah, the one thing we may want to check is there are two crossings that we're looking at, and I wonder if it's also delineated by, you know, one in the morning might be the Manville crossing.
Oh, I bet it is.
And one in the afternoon.
The one in the morning is Manville. That's the one at 10:30 in the hearing room. The Bismarck one is 1:30 in the afternoon in the Brynhild Hoagland room. Morning room, of course, will be – the morning one will be broadcast video cast. The afternoon is in. Yeah, just said that. Yeah.
Thanks.
Tape delay.
And that's at 10 a.m.
Yes.
It is. Yeah. The afternoon.
Okay, so 10 a.m. is the Manville crossing. 1:30 on March 1st is the
Frayne Barracks crossing.
Yes.
All right. Any questions?
On FirstLink, there's reference in the order to the lack of stable long-term funding. How has this service been financed?
It was my understanding with MHAND, they had a grant that they were operating under, and the grant has since been, they've used all the resources. FirstLink works with United Way of Cass County, the way I understand it, and that's where they get their funding.
Yeah. Right, and I think that's kind of the way it developed, if I remember correctly, is Mental Health North Dakota had the grant and was trying to get other money and operate the statewide one. The reason that Cass County, a few years ago, we sort of cleaved off, and they operated as a subcontractor, FirstLink as a subcontractor for MHAND, as they had Cass County United Way money available to them that wasn't available to mental health. And so it's been a constant struggle, and you can see why. I mean, it's, you know, if you're looking at a strict business case, there's probably nothing that supports it. It has to be a subsidized service.
That's right. And it was actually a vote of the United Way of Cass Clay that ultimately determined that they could no longer operate it on as a statewide service because they didn't have the funding, and it is outside of their jurisdiction and area of responsibility, while at the same time, they didn't come to that conclusion easily because, of course, they're advocates for mental health and on behalf of the mentally ill and those that have need for services. And so it's been a real struggle for them. And as Brian said earlier, it's, you know, our responsibility does not go beyond designating the 211 number, but our moral responsibility and our role as advocates for people compels us to at least explore other possibilities. I had a conversation last evening, in fact, in Fargo with some potential donor types to see if we can't try to at least build a bridge through this biennium so that service could be provided some other way until we get to the next session, at which time I know there are some legislators that would like to see if they couldn't do something more permanent.
If I could, too, Dale, that one of the things, I was at the State American Legion Convention last weekend, and the Legion's handing out these Courage Carry On flyers about the returning vets and all their potential challenges, and they have listed as, you know, dial 211 if you need services. So, you know, there's organizations like the Legion and others that have, you know, have put significant resources into making sure this service is available. So, you know, we don't want this service to fall through. So, and there are people out there that have designed a marketing plan around this. And that's one of the things, like Tony talked about in the work session, is maybe part of the problem for 211 is just marketing itself, that there are a lot of people out there that are using the services, but they just assume it's there. And we sent our notification out, but maybe they didn't notice it. So now Scott's trying to get a hold of our PR person to the people and get them to this meeting and get something put together before the March 15th deadline, if you will.
When you talk about the stakeholder groups, who do you perceive those as being?
Well, the Legion being first one of them. You know, I don't have that off the top of my head.
Department of Human Services would be a big one. National Guard. Any of the social service agencies or nonprofit social service organizations, non-governmental organizations are probably likely candidates. And we'll be doing what we can to contact them so that they can come to this meeting. And I know Scott's going to be putting together a news release and hopefully we'll get out as much information as we can so at least people know for their own purposes if for whatever reason, if no organization can step up and provide the service by then, at least people will know that it's not going to be operational through most of the state after March 15th.
Do you have any idea when this meeting's going to be scheduled?
I think we had a rough date that we were going to try to schedule the three of us of February 18th, but we won't be able to lock that in until scheduling when all three of us look.
Yeah, in a little bit. Mental health service providers are many. They're diverse. They are spread across the state, and it seems to me that the lack of ability to really coordinate and identify even who they all are is a bit of the problem. They also, by nature, mental health service providers are recipients of charity, not contributors of charity. So consequently, while they're out there in many cases scraping up money, seeking donations and contributions and the benevolence of citizens to provide the service, it doesn't do very much good if the communication link between the people who need the service and the service providers is broken. And that's what I fear is happening if we don't have somebody at a state level that operates the 211 services.
One of the things that concerns me, beyond mental health services, this is a general kind of need helpline for all sorts of human services, whether it be elderly referral. It was used heavily during last year's flood because there are just certain social services that need to be delivered during emergency crisis times. And, you know, March 15th is getting dangerously close to flood time in North Dakota, and we know that this is expected to be another year where we face significant challenges there. So it'd be a good thing if we can somehow find a way to have a designated provider step forward, and I know we'd be happy to designate someone if there's somebody willing to do the service.
Does First Link, I'm just wondering if someone does step forward and say we could be the statewide provider, is First Link going to have a problem with that?
When we spoke with First Link, one of the things that I asked them was, is that, you know, how much money would it take you to provide this service statewide? And they felt that with, you know, another $100,000 additional what they already spend, they could provide the services statewide. So I think one avenue would be if someone provides the services or the money, they could then provide the services. But and if someone else came forward to do the rest of the state, I think that would go back to the model that was in place before, that they could do Cass County and let someone else do the state. So I don't think they'd be opposed to that.
Right. It's, I mean, one of the things that First Link has an advantage is that they have what's called an AIRS certification, and I can't remember exactly what it stands for. It's like Alliance of Information Referral Services, I think. And so they have a significant amount of training in doing this. Mental Health in North Dakota also had that designation. It'd be nice if we could get an agency that already has that type of expertise and that body of knowledge to be able to do it. And so, I mean, First Link's a natural fit, but it is a funding issue for them. And, you know, if we do find a statewide provider, you know, we could go with that provider statewide if they're qualified. We could still run, you know, a similar situation where First Link is operating well in the Cass area. You might just have Cass County operate under First Link and someone else do the rest of the state.
Do you have any idea how much it costs to operate this service statewide?
I've heard it's in the neighborhood of $200,000.
Per year?
Per year.
Okay. Has there been any discussion of approaching the legislature for...
Senator Judy Lee has talked to us numerous times.
I'm quite certain that there will be an attempt in the next legislative session to fund First Link or some other, you know, provider. It's the bridge between now and then that we have the challenge with. And that's why I think that the best strategy at this point is to try and find somebody who can provide the funding so that First Link can continue to provide the service, because that's working. We can piece it together. I think there have been some attempts to contact the United Ways of the various United Way chapters around the state, with limited success. But there's a lot of bureaucracy in all of that as well. So to find a single grant perhaps might be a more efficient way. But at any rate, there's some urgency about it because March 15th is coming up soon.
And public funding for these is not unheard of. I mean, it wouldn't be the first one. 511, I don't know specifically, but I assume that there's state money that goes into 511 supporting road condition reports. 911 is most certainly publicly funded. 811's a little bit different in that it's primarily private industry, but there are public monies that go into supporting the work of 811 as well, including federal grants that come through this agency to spend on advertising.
Do you have any idea how often the service is used, what their call traffic is?
I do not.
MHAND gave us that information off the top of my head. I can't remember. It was several thousand calls a year, but I don't know exactly.
The organic grain and milling, if they come in with a bond, is all forgiven? Is that what?
I believe they have to reapply at this point because it's been revoked.
Okay. And do they have any assets? Do they have any grain in their elevator?
Do you know that? I'll ask Sue if we've vended the facility. I do not know. Or just use Dale's.
Pat fiddled with it to get it to work.
Okay, thank you. When a license is revoked, the company has to either make redelivery back to the farmers, or they have to purchase a grain at that time. And what they have been doing is working with the farmers to have the grain, most of it they're moving over to the state mill, having the farmers picking it up and take it over to the state mill because they handle organic grain over there. And they have one producer that they were going to be purchasing the grain from, and it was a smaller amount.
Okay. So they do have product, and they're returning it more or less to the farmers to do something else with it?
Correct. That's what they've told us. The commission asked for an update last week. Staff did, and we are still waiting for them to respond to us.
Okay. Can you tell me? Thank you. Could you please tell me the corridor in the Basin power line case, mm-hmm. it's 6 miles wide?
It's a 6 mile corridor, and the way that the statute and rules read, that's what is provided for, and 6 miles is a maximum corridor. However, the commission can pare that back if we choose to. In practice, usually companies have just followed the formula, and if they max out at 6, they apply for a 6 mile corridor. Like I said, I think it's probably likely in future cases, because of the new law that's on the books, that the commission will purposefully pare that back a bit, and it's simply to be a bit of a protection, a hedge, if you will, for landowners themselves, because when you're talking about a significant corridor like this, a 60-mile long route, 6 miles corridor, that leaves a lot of space that a company could come in and build other projects. In fact, there was even some questions that we had at the work session. Could you site generation facilities in a corridor for a route permit, for a transmission line? I think it's a little bit unclear. I don't know that we had the specific answer there, but it's a new law. There are always questions of interpretation that go along with that, and we'll continue to look at it. There's even, the commission raised questions, Basin felt comfortable, but the commission had questions about, well, could a separate company come in and attempt to build in a previously permitted site? Basin felt comfortable saying no because of some language in the law. But the commission will keep track of it, and you know, perhaps we'll come to the legislature for a few refinements just to clarify that. But still too early to tell.
You know, one of the questions that came to mind was, you know, does Basin have a property interest in the corridor? Once it's granted, can they sell it? Can they say, you know, hey, we've got this corridor?
Well, the certificate would have to be transferred, and we would have to approve the transfer of certificate.
As a practical matter, shrinking a corridor from 6 miles to, say, 1 mile, the ramifications of that is it takes away the flexibility should something occur during construction that would maybe cause the route to be, you know, switched a little bit. So that creates a bit of a problem. I think it's important to note that the purpose of the legislation in the first place was to sort of take down some of the regulatory burdens that got in the way of construction of projects that were literally just improvements on existing projects that they felt they shouldn't have to come back to the commission, you know, to replace a 100 horsepower pump with a 200 horsepower pump on the same footprint, for example. So that was noble and is reasonable. This was probably one of the unintended consequences of that legislation. At the same time, it also should be noted that the legislation does require that if there's new construction done in a corridor, that the company does certify with us that there are no avoidance and exclusion areas that are violated and those types of things. So it's not like they just get to do any crazy thing they want.
Right. I mean, to the degree that the statute's been used so far, it's at least in one case, and I can't remember if it's been more, but I think one. I mean, that's currently just been applied for. It's been used as intended. I mean, it was a pumping facility, and the company, it was Enbridge in that case, decided to do some remodeling basically on that, and they certified to us that it wasn't affecting any of those exclusion or avoidance areas. So it worked as intended, but the questions that start to arise with a case like this are, for example, 60-mile line, 6 miles wide. If a company holds that permit, that's a big enough space to put a wind farm in, a significant wind farm. So I can't imagine that the legislature's intent was to allow that statute to be used to totally circumvent, say, major generation projects going in, a coal plant, wind farms, nuclear plant, simply because they have a certificate for a transmission line. And so the commission is, as I said, in the future will probably pare back a bit or at least take into consideration a bit more those corridor certificates. Companies will know that when they apply to us, but also appreciate Basin's willingness to self-agree to, if there is anything else done in this corridor, to come before the commission again.
You still have transmission line construction requests pending, do you?
Oh, yes, we do.
Well, Elite was the other one, but in that one, the corridor was quite small because the line itself was quite small.
See, the statute reads, Dale, that the corridor is 10% of the length up to 6 miles.
Okay.
So if it's a 10-mile, you know, route, then it's a 1-mile corridor.
Okay. I mean, how do Do you have any thoughts on how wide a corridor should be if it isn't 6 miles? I mean, 6 miles sounds like a lot. In fact, 1 mile sounds like a lot.
Well, you have to, I mean, remember that I mean, in practice, the commission has consolidated these, and that's been that way as long as I've been on the commission, for a long time before. But in theory, the reason that the legislature wrote this as such was a company would first come in and attempt to get a corridor certificate that would be quite large, which would then put basically landowners on notice within that the line was going to be constructed. But then the second proceeding, the route, would define exactly where it would go. In practice, it has not tended to happen that way for a whole bunch of reasons. One of them is probably litigation strategy, that you have to get two bites at the apple, basically, if you followed that to the T.
Dale, if I could just throw a flip side to that, you know, I think there is some value, though, to establishing corridors in the state where you could put your development so you'd have responsible development. You know, but the challenge would be that the landowners that have that corridor, you know, could lose all 6 miles in. So if you're the landowner that affected it, you know, you might not like that one bit, but it could give you responsible development for the power lines and pipelines and whatever else you have, so you don't have this stuff running all over the state. I mean, I've seen those in larger states, and they worked, but I don't know that we're headed that way.
Okay, back to the 211. I'm sorry I didn't ask this earlier, but if you dial 211 on March 16th and you don't live in Cass County, what's going to happen?
I believe the switching services will just say number not available.
It's just a programming issue at the local switch.
And that is the extent of their service area for the 211 is just Cass County, not like Cass Trail.
Well, that's a good question. Their jurisdiction is just Cass and Clay, I think. Clay County, Minnesota, as well. But
do you
know,
have the authority to assign 211 for Clay County?
No, but they do have it over there.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's just going to work for Cass County only, just so I'm clear about
yeah.
that. On the consent agenda, can you tell me the extent of the bond reduction on
I can, and I looked at it this morning, but let me pull it out. It's a self bond from $51,255,000 to $46,850,400, and then a collateral bond will go from $5,695,000 to $5,205,600.
Why is this being granted? Do they have less land?
So the drop in fuel costs from December of 08 to July of last year. So the worst case scenario, of course, changes. Isn't it amazing the impact that fuel costs have on things?
Big effect.
It's a big impact, yeah.
There's one other thing I wanted to clarify on the order on the transmission line. There's reference to suspension insulation with a clearance of approximately 84 inches in order to eliminate potential for the electrocution of rafters. Is suspension insulation those kind of sleeves that you see on the line?
I believe so. It's funny that you caught that because I read by that and I thought, well, I'm going to ask Pat this later because unless Dale asked me, it's Dale asked me.
Why 84 inches? Why not 26 or 59?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they certified to us. I believe that the insulation is, as you suggested, that the number of inches, I'm not sure. It may be.
Do we have
some
a lot of rafters flying around in North Dakota? I really don't.
Well, in that part of the state, I think there are actually quite a few. I mean, you've got golden eagles and different falcons and hawks. And
there's a different standard that Basin is held to sometimes because they have a federal nexus. Mm-hmm. So they have to go through and do a NEPA or an environmental impact statement. And my guess is that in order for them to get those things they need, they have to put these kind of devices in the lines. We had a hearing up in Center just the other day, and it came up about bird deflectors. And so there's some liability that the companies are choosing to, I believe, offset by putting some of these devices in there.
No question.
And that's what I think.
And can we talk, do you know what a bird flight diverter is?
it's something that
apparatus.
Hangs out of optically
little reflectors.
The line, a reflector.
Yeah, they've become less. Well, you know, the big, we're used to the big orange balls, but for like airplanes and stuff. But now there are these little reflectors are quite interesting. But Brian's talking about, we asked the question. I think
in center,
how much?
It was $500,000
for a 20-mile line. You know, I mean, 22-mile line.
For the bird deflectors, because I asked the question during the
those
hearing.
Those are whooping crane ones, so they're special deflectors.
Yeah, they're
but
very special.
But the point, though, being that I believe the companies are now, you know, doing the worst-case scenario for installing devices, that if something happens that they kill a whooping crane or they kill some of these threatened species, then they've got some coverage inside the law. That's just my opinion.
Oh, yeah, I'm
that.
Sure it's risk mitigation. I'm
so
sure
they figure they put this money up front.
So yeah. 20-some miles, $500,000 for bird deflectors.
I actually separately asked somebody about, you know, what kind of, I mean, how heavy are these, how heavy are these fines that Fish and Wildlife can mete out? And apparently they can run, you know, tens of millions of dollars, and but even more than the fine issue, because you could do kind of an actuarial study and say, well, okay, $500,000 for the bird deflectors versus, you know, the likelihood that you'd get the, okay, is what's worth it. But the even more than that are criminal penalties that can be filed against utility companies and their executives. I mean, so it really is, it's a liability issue for utility companies, risk mitigation.
I mean, I didn't define the file to speak to, but I just wondered why it was specified that this was for raptors, you know.
Well, raptors cover a wide range of birds, obviously, but I think mainly aimed at eagles.
Right. And I think there's a fairly sizable, I don't think this was in the testimony, but there's a fairly sizable native bald eagle population along the Missouri River, and this is fairly close to the river.
All right.
When are you going to schedule the first link thing?
Is that on scheduling today?
It's on scheduling today.
It's on scheduling today.
Scott will let you know right away, right, Scott?
All right. If there's nothing else, we'll recess for now and sign orders and come back for the administrative portion of the meeting at 10 minutes before 11.